This is case number 51673, Katrina Duncan, an individual, versus Gregory Carter individually and Glenn Carter individually. This is a northern panel consisting of Justice Seda on my left, Justice Gibbons on my right, Justice Cherry. One inquiry to Mr. Christensen, because of prior election things, is there any problem with Justice Gibbons or Justice Seda sitting on this case?
Oh, not.
Thank you. Thank you. And you're up first, Mr. Christensen.
Fairly friendly.
Yeah. Certainly.
Thank you, Your Honors. First of all, I would like to thank the justices for having the hearings down here. I'm in favor of that, too. And also thank the justices and the Supreme Court for their diligence in having oral argument and giving my client the opportunity to have these issues heard and decided by the court. This case, there's a cross appeal, and so I had one question about procedurally. Do you want me to go over everything in my first thing here, or how's?
Whatever you're comfortable with.
I think Mr. Christensen would have a right, because of the cross appeal,
yeah,
to argue last.
Right.
After Mr. Shute argues on the cross appeal issue, so
right.
You could reserve time as well on that if you want to. You don't have to, but you could. Mm.
All right. Well, we'll see. We'll see what I get to. All right. First on my appeal, the main issue that I think needs addressing here is the whole issue about what a treating physician is, what their status is with our the district court and trial bar, and we need direction on
now,
that.
My understanding, Ms. Duncan went to Dr. Cabins as to treat her.
Correct.
And he treated her. She didn't tell him about this latter incident, the subsequent injury, and all. And I guess to me that's the key issue. I might ask both sides. I mean, if I were the trial judge, I would have let Cabins testify and then let you cross-examine him about the latter and what an impact that has on his opinion. I was a little surprised the judge precluded him from testifying. And again, the issue would be to Mr. Christensen, is that enough to cause a reversal, or is that something that's harmless? You know, those are my issues. I haven't prejudged it, but I mean, I'd like both of all the issues in the case. Those are the ones that really kind of grab my attention. You know,
right? And I intend to get to that. He was allowed to testify.
Right, but not give an opinion on.
He couldn't. He had to pretend that he had never seen and didn't know about the electrocution electric shock. She was not electrocuted. She
yeah.
wouldn't be here
yeah.
to be a plaintiff. But the electric shock ER record, and the ER record didn't have anything that there was any kind of injury to the back.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was a very important aspect of this. But to get to the concept that the clear error by Judge Barker was saying that Cabins was not a treating physician, and you're right. He was consulted as a second opinion, and in the appellate's appendix, volume 4, which is day 3 of the file, page 15, day 3 of the trial, page 15, line 3 through 10, Judge Barker goes through some of his reasoning behind thinking that Cabins was not a treating physician, and he says he didn't treat her, he didn't give her any medication, but that's really not even the question, because the rule that he's functioning under is 16.1, which says if you're retained specifically for this case, you have to have a report, and that was the thing that he was saying, is that that since he wasn't a treating physician in his mind, then he had to have a report. And that's the thing that the trial bar needs some direction on. And, you know, the...
I mean, does this happen often? You try a lot of these cases.
Yeah, what happens is it's a very confused situation. The rule, I think, is there for the purpose of saying you don't have to go spend thousands and thousands of dollars on treating physicians to get them to trial, to be able to testify in front of them, because that's not what they do for a living. But what the Discovery Commissioner has done with that district court, federal district court case that says, which I don't think we're bound by the federal district court, but have said is, well, they can testify as a treating physician, but they can't consider anything that they don't have in their actual record, which is absurd from a practice point of view. As an example, I just had a medical malpractice trial where the neurosurgeon had his medical record. His medical record was 47 pages that he maintains in his office. But he testified all over the place about the medical record of the hospital, which is not his medical record, but obviously a treating physician has access to those things and has information and gleans information and should be allowed to testify about those things. All right. So now I'll move on to your other question, which is, well, isn't this a big tempest in a teapot? No, it isn't. And that's as a result of the other things that happened in this trial surrounding this very piece of evidence. Just to put this into perspective, I wanted to quote from defendant's or respondent's brief. He says, and this is page 13 of his brief, during his closing, plaintiff's counsel repeatedly made personal attacks and continually stepped up the personal attacks up to the point that the motion for mistrial was made. And I have pointed out in my response, if pleading, that where are these repeated personal attacks and stepping up these personal attacks that you're quoting here in your brief? And because I said, you know, I've looked through the thing, I don't see it. There were no objections made to anything in the first, this is the first trial. There were no objections made in the first trial. And the quote that was finally objected to in the first trial was, why in the world would you put, and this is Gary Fink arguing the case, why in the world would you put up Dr. Rosen, a general orthopedic surgeon, against Dr. Dunn? That makes no sense other than, well, I don't know, they couldn't find one, is that possible? Or maybe they did find one, and that spine surgeon maybe looked at stuff and said, I agree with Dr. Dunn. I don't know, okay. And that was the objected to language that caused a mistrial in the first case. And that was the first objection. And as I set out in my brief, we said, there are ways that we can cure this. And defense counsel cut us off once and the judge cut us off the other time. And no effort was made to cure that particular alleged misconduct. The reason I bring that out is because that is similar to the misquoting of the record that we get into that causes this problem with the ER record to become such an issue in the case. And that's in my reply brief, where I go through in great detail with quotes to the record of where Mr. McGahey continually went back to, this is she's an admitted perjurer, which is overstating the cause. She's an admitted liar, and why is she hiding this record from all of her treating physicians? It's because it messes with her case. That those are quotes from the record. On the other hand, defense counsel or respondents put quotes in their brief. One is doctor shopping. And I just read to the court the argument by appellate's counsel, and doctor shopping is not in there anywhere. And so there's a tendency, both in the trial and in the appeal, to misquote the record. And this misquoting of the record and the finding by the trial judge that we couldn't go into it with Dr. Cabins, whether this record was important, whether he would have expected her to have told him about it. You know, it's the same thing when you go to the doctor and they say, have you had any other injuries to your back? You don't tell them about the time you went in for the sniffles or the time you stubbed your toe. And that's exactly what this shock record was. Their own expert at the trial testified that he couldn't say to a reasonable degree of medical certainty that she received any additional injuries as a result of the shock incident that required an ER visit, and then she was released. And I'll reserve the rest of my time.
Thank you. Ms. Schutz.
Thank you. I'll just focus right in on Justice Gibbons' question. It's not really at all a confusing issue. We don't need, trial lawyers don't need any more direction than what we have. It's really a simple issue that a treating physician should be allowed to testify about expert opinions relating to anything that he learns during the course of his treatment. That makes perfect sense because those are the exact things that he's treating a person with. In other words, during the course of somebody's treatment. And let me back up.
Well, but if he subsequently learns about this other injury that happened after the accident, why shouldn't he be allowed to testify about that? And then you certainly you can cross-examine him heavily on that point. It wasn't disclosed and so on and so forth, but I don't see why he should be precluded from testifying on that as long as he has the expert qualifications, you know, because he still was a treating physician. So that's my thought. So that's issue one. Issue two, assuming I'm right this supposition's correct, tell me why you think it still doesn't warrant a new trial. Those are the issues I'm concerned about.
So. Okay. Let me gather my thoughts here for a second. Why should he be allowed to testify about it? Because we have to have some sort of, we have all these rules in place so that we don't have trial by ambush. Mm-hmm. 16.1 is one of those rules. If and during the course, and you were practicing attorney before you were judge, there's a mechanism for lawyers to find out what the case is about. Initially, as I'm sure you're aware, defense lawyers subpoena records from the doctors. They get the plaintiff doctor's charts. And then we look at them, and we make sure we appreciate everything that's in those charts, and then sometimes we depose those doctors. In this case, Dr. Cabins was identified as a second opinion doctor. He saw Ms. Duncan one time after the electrocution, and he said, yeah, I think she's a surgical candidate.
Well, but he was deposed before.
No, he wasn't deposed.
Well, wouldn't you have to depose him, though, to nail down his opinion?
He wasn't given those materials until 2 weeks or so before the second trial.
Okay.
And so our position was he didn't learn about this in the course of his treatment. And Barker never said that he wasn't a treating doctor. He said he's an improperly designated expert. He didn't come across this information about the electrocution during the course of his treatment because, as both sides agree, Ms. Duncan said, I didn't tell anybody about it. She withheld that from Dr. Cabins, as she did everybody else. That was drawn out in the trial. So, go through the first trial. It's mistried. We wait 6 months for the second trial. 2 weeks or so before the second trial, Cabins is given all of the other records that he didn't have when he was treating her, and he was going to be asked expert opinions about his review of those other records. And that was ambush. He wasn't identified as an expert that was going to
When did you discover that Cabins got these records at that time, and that he was going to be asked to testify what impact this subsequent injury had on his opinion.
At the second trial.
You didn't know about it until the middle of the trial?
It was when he came to the stand, he had a, and with all due respect, Mr. Christensen wasn't at the trial, but Cavins came up with a gigantic notebook, and we were saying, gosh, this chart that we subpoenaed was about 3 millimeters thick. He had one report, a six-page report, yet he has this gigantic binder. And Mr. Omar, one of the plaintiff's counsels that was there, said to Judge Barker, I gave those things to him. And he repeatedly said in the record, I'm not lying about it. I just gave it to him. Because there was some discussion about, gosh, when did he get all this stuff? Do we have to cross-examine him now in front of the jury about when he got the records and all that? And the plaintiff's counsel repeatedly said, I gave it to him recently, just a couple of weeks ago, just before this trial. And so Barker's thought process was, this is trial by ambush. He wasn't identified as an expert witness. He was identified as a treating physician. And now he's been given 1,700 pages of records or something along those lines, 900 pages, I mean, of records 2 weeks before the second trial. And he was going to be asked to comment on things that he never learned about during the course of his treatment.
Was there any interrogatories, anything set
yes.
between the first and second trial, asking the experts for any updates
no.
on their opinions or something like that to try and close out that issue? Did you do that?
Well, I couldn't, and I'll address it from the front and back side.
Okay.
There was an order at the end of the first trial because my thought process was, right or wrong, it was a deliberate mistrial because the first trial went very poorly for the plaintiffs. And I thought, maybe they're going to try to do some more work to clean the case up. And I got an order from Judge Barker at the end of the first trial, no more discovery. So I wasn't allowed to do that. But I did do expert interrogatories, irrespective of the obligations of plaintiff under 16.1, expert interrogatories. Who are your experts? What are their opinions? That was never responded to. It was just a circular thing, CR 16.1 production. Well, that's not where
you... So it was never supplemented that...
No.
Cavins is going to now say that the subsequent injury would not affect his first opinion.
Correct. So in other words, subsequent discovery was technically provided by virtue of giving Cavins materials that he did not have during the first trial.
Well, Cavins didn't come to the first trial.
Okay.
Yes, but you're right.
Okay.
2 weeks before the second trial, Mr. Omar, if that's his correct name, met with Cavins. There was a $1,500 charge for it, and he gave him all the medical records and bills that Cavins never had before. So that was a thought process. If plaintiff wanted Cavins to testify and he'd have done it right, or she'd have done it right and given all these materials to Cavins before the discovery cutoff, then this would be a different case. And Cavins would have testified, and Barker said that. But Barker said, this is trial by ambush. If you got an expert, you got to disclose him. There was not supposed to be any more discovery between the two trials. That's clearly what's going on. I can't let this happen.
Okay.
So in terms of the prejudice from that, or you said, or Mr. Christensen said, tempest in a teapot, Dr. Dunn, the surgeon, talked about the electrocution at length. What's Cavins going to do? It's going to be duplicative. It's going to be cumulative. Cavins wasn't the surgeon. How about Dr. Dunn, who saw Ms. Duncan prior to her electrocution, after her electrocution, and he's the one who did the surgery. He found out about it from me, by the way. I'm the one who told him about the electrocution. He found out about it, and he testified about it. So having Cavins come in and just say something else that the actual surgeon already said is really just cumulative. It's a waste of time. Plaintiff doesn't need to bring in multiple experts to say the same thing, especially somebody who didn't know about it when he was making his original opinions because the plaintiff failed to tell him about it. The other issues, I guess, procedurally, should I talk about my cross-appeal issues now?
Go ahead.
Okay. I just would like to point out that in terms of the cases that were cited by the appellant, or I guess the respondent on cross-appeal, they don't really exactly say what they say they say. And with regards to the, let's see. I'll just, let me go through it in order. And it's kind of tied together here. We're complaining about the fact that we weren't awarded any fees or costs on the mistrial. And that ties into our issues with the court's denial of our motion to retax, because the court didn't bother to separate the plaintiff's costs from trial one and trial two. So in other words, not only did we get penalized by the mistrial by having to incur costs for two trials, we're also double penalized because we're essentially having to pay, or we've been ordered to pay, plaintiff's costs for two trials with zero effort to separate the costs from the two trials. And in plaintiff's, appellant's own responding brief on the cross appeal, they admitted that $6,500 of the expert costs were associated with the first trial, and they admitted that about a little under $1,000 of the costs related to the subpoenas were for the first trial. It just doesn't make sense that they'd get to mistry the case and then get to collect their costs associated with the mistrial from us. And then we get the double penalty of not getting any costs on the mistrial. So one of the issues on the mistrial was whether or not it was intentional. We addressed in the brief that that's not really the focus, the analysis. Whether or not they intentionally caused the misconduct isn't so much the focus as their conduct that led to the mistrial being intentional. And we deliberately made the decision not to object to some of the arguments or the closing arguments that led up to the mistrial because we didn't want to call attention to those arguments. But there were lots of personal attacks. But ultimately, it got to the point where plaintiff's counsel was arguing that we were doctor shopping. That he said that why didn't we get a spine surgeon? We couldn't find one that would agree with us, that maybe we did find a spine surgeon and we didn't like what he had to say. But he's arguing that we're, without any basis in evidence, that we doctor shop, that we deliberately chose a doctor that would give a favorable opinion and concealed some doctors that wouldn't give us favorable opinion.
We'd have to find like an abuse of discretion by the trial judge, because the order that, in fact, you prepared says the single question is whether plaintiff purposely caused the mistrial to occur. The court does not find that it was a purposeful act nor a pattern from a single attorney. Should we be second-guessing the judge in this matter?
No. And I can't point to, and I looked all morning, I can't point to some specific thing in the record that Barker did wrong on that. I'm just being honest.
I appreciate that, too. And I knew you would be, Mr. Schutz, knowing you a long time. Go ahead.
I guess on the cross appeal, the biggest issue would be zero effort by the court, by the trial court, to separate plaintiff's costs between the mistried case and the trial that went all the way through. That just doesn't seem reasonable.
Can I go back to the Cabins thing?
Yes.
He didn't testify in the first trial.
No.
Okay. When did you know he was going to testify in the second trial?
When he showed up on day 3 of the trial.
I mean, he wasn't identified on a witness list or anything under rule, what, 2.67, 2.68?
I don't recall that occurring. I recall the discussion being, hey, why don't you tell us who you're going to be calling tomorrow so that we can, over the course of trial, so we can plan our schedules, and we're going to call who we're going to call. We don't have to tell you.
So he could have been excluded on that basis alone, presumably.
I guess presumably. We never raised the issue.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think it's kind of important now. I guess we're going back to discovery, but if whether or not he was identified as a witness, like that, because it kind of, I think, may impact how we vote on the case, like that. So
my recollection, again, and I didn't go back and study the record to look for that. My recollection was on the second trial, things were perhaps a little contentious because of some things that happened in the first trial, and, you know, we're going to call our witnesses when we call them.
Well, I guess you could say that, you know, but the thing is, you got to have, I assume was there 2.67 conference held before the second trial and all, or, I mean.
No.
Yeah, I know it's kind of strange because you have the mistrial from the first trial, then they kind of meld together on the two trials, so the rules get kind of murky and all, and I appreciate both the dilemma of both sides, but I'm just trying to logically sort this out on how it normally
happens. We didn't have a second conference. We had one before the first.
Okay.
Actually, it was, we had two conferences before the first trial, a long telephone conference and then a personal meeting at my office, but the second trial, we just showed up.
Okay. Thanks.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Schutz. Mr. Christensen, rebuttal and...
Yeah, Mr. Christensen, maybe you can answer my question. Was Dr. Cavins identified as a witness?
I think I can answer that. We put in our appellate's opening brief, and I'm not prepared to, you know, because and I didn't try the case, so
okay.
I can't...
Okay, well, we had your opening brief here.
Our opening brief said he was identified, and then, interestingly enough, in their responsive brief, they say... Although Dr. Cavins was named as a treating and expert witness in Plaintiff's Nevada Rules of Civil Procedure 16.1 initial disclosures, Dr. Cavins was not appropriately identified as an expert in this matter.
Okay.
Therefore, he was limited to testify as a treating physician. But that's not even what he was allowed to testify as, even a treating physician. And I think that's an erroneous reading of the rule 16.1. that a treating physician has to have a report. That's what he goes on to say in their opening brief, or their responsive brief, is that he wasn't properly identified because he didn't provide a report.
But did I hear correctly, and I'm sorry to interrupt your train of thought, did I hear correctly that the respondent's brief, which I did not bring on the bench,
I have it here, but
actually acknowledges that Dr. Cavins was identified both as a treater and an expert?
Correct. Which should put the issue to rest, I think. But,
well, can you explain one other thing? I hate to interrupt, but on the electrocution, the ladder fall, can you kind of explain to us what happened here exactly, how she got hurt in this second entry? You know,
and that's even partly how come it makes sense that she wouldn't identify it. Her husband found her at home next to a ladder, where she was working on an electrical thing in the ceiling or on the wall, you know, like an electrical outlet,
mm-hmm.
or a light mm-hmm. fixture, and apparently zapped herself. And she was unconscious at the foot of the ladder.
How tall was the ladder, though?
I don't know.
Okay.
But it wasn't a huge ladder,
okay.
and it was in a hallway, so 8 foot.
And she had no broken bones or anything from...
Yeah, and so she was out. He called the ambulance, and they came, and she had come to by that point in time, and then they took her in the ambulance as a precaution to the ER, and at the ER, they actually said they wanted to keep her as a result of the shock, but she said, I think I'm feeling okay, and so she didn't even stay to be observed. And
okay,
so that's the extent of the record. And in fact, in the record, it says she had had a back injury, you know, in this automobile accident. It references that particular thing, but it doesn't talk about any treatment for the back or any symptoms of the back at the time that she's in the emergency room. To answer another I'll just read the quote from the trial. The court, I understand. The decision that I made was based upon a couple factors. The fact was that Dr. Cavan saw the plaintiff, Mrs. Duncan, one time, and, you know, the definition of treating physician is loosely defined based upon my reading, but he didn't prescribe for her. He didn't treat her in any way. He looked at her as almost a second opinion to Dunn based upon what he said yesterday. Define the treating physician as you will. And so, you know, it's clear that Judge Barker didn't.
She went to Dunn. I went to Cavins for treatment. She didn't go to Cavins. Cavins was hired as an expert. That's the way I understand it. Is that correct? I mean, she went to get treatment from.
Right, right. But it's just a second opinion. But Judge Barker thought that is somehow different.
I see.
From
okay.
a treating physician. And it's not. It would be difficult to handle things if that's the way it was. I'm almost done. the only other thing I'd say, is the motion for new trial, based on the misconduct of the defendant in this case, was heard without oral argument, and no findings pursuant to Leo C. were ever entered by the court. And that reason alone, this should be reversed and sent back. Thank you.
Well, thank you, Mr. Schutz and Mr. Christensen, for your briefs and your argument. This case will stand submitted.
Yes? Justice Chair, can I make
sure.
one comment? I guess we made it in the previous cases about the opinions versus orders. Generally, the panel doesn't do opinions. I mean, it can. I mean, it's not prohibited from doing it, but the idea is to have an en banc court, seven people issue opinions to the court. I know Mr. Christensen's publicly stated that we need more opinions, which probably the three of us agree with and all, but generally that's the mechanism to get them with the en banc court. That way, the problem is if we issue an opinion and then the other four people say, we don't agree with you, it revokes the opinion. So the idea is to get it where, at least you get four votes, then it becomes binding precedent. So that's generally the process we go through on the opinion versus order. Just for clarification, so you both knew that.
You have some time left. I'm sorry.
I had 50.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
I just wanted to address one question.
My fault. Absolutely, Mr. Schutz. Go ahead.
I apologize for jumping into your...
Well, you guys are the bosses, so you call it.
No, go ahead.
Justice Stata asked, did I hear right that the respondent acknowledged? I want you to hear right. It wasn't a proper designation. This particular plaintiff's firm identifies every single medical witness in their original 16.1 as treating physician / expert. But there's a whole bunch of rules that talk about expert disclosures.
The treating physicians can give expert opinions.
Correct. Within the federal case is clear about, as long as they learn about it in the course of their treatment. And what the judge said, and it's in the appellant's appendix volume 1, and it's page 196, line 7, Judge Barker, I believe the disclosure of the information to the witness, Dr. Cavins, is outside the discovery. Discovery was closed. As a consequence of understanding that, I'm not going to allow you to get into it.
Okay. Well, I appreciate that. The federal district court case is persuasive, but it's not binding authority
Correct.
On us. So whether we agree with that or not, it's our probably the seven justices' call at some point in time to clarify that issue.
Okay. Well, we thank both attorneys again, and again, the case is submitted. We're recessed until 1:30.